Well, indeed, this is Focus 580. My name's David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. 10 years ago, the Institute of Medicine issued a landmark study estimating that somewhere between 44,000 and 98,000 people died every year as a result of medical errors. And that would make medical mistakes the eighth leading cause of death in the United States, ahead of vehicle accidents, breast cancer, and AIDS. This morning, in this hour, we'll be talking about patient and hospital safety. And our guest for the program is Dr. Robert Wachter. He is professor and associate chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also chief of the Division of Hospital Medicine and chief of the Medical Service at UCSF Medical Center. He's done a lot of writing on the subject of quality safety health policy. He coined the term hospitalist in an article that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. He's past president of the Society of Hospital Medicine, and he's also written on this subject. He's written a book entitled Internal Bleeding, The Truth Behind America's Terrifying Epidemic of Medical Mistakes. That book is now in its fourth printing. Has a more recent book that deals with the same subject, and this is a textbook that is used in medical education. The title of that book is Understanding Patient Safety, and it's a very widely used book in this field. This morning, we'll be talking about this particular issue and also inviting questions from people who are listening in. And all you have to do to join the conversation is call us. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. And that's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you want to join in the conversation, you just pick up the telephone and give us a call. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their questions brief, but we ask that just so we could move things along and get in as many different callers as possible. So certainly your questions are welcome. Dr. Wachter, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
I'm just great. Thanks.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I want to, again, go back to this report that was issued back in 1999. This was something that I think was people in your field, I'm sure, feel was very important and also was very influential. It got people really talking about this particular issue. I mean, people within the medical community, certainly. And it got a lot of coverage in the popular media as well. I was taking a look at your book, Internal Bleeding, that was published in 2004. And at that point, you noted that 5 years after that, this big report, things were not doing so much better in the area of patient safety. So how about I ask the question, well, it's been 10 years now. So how are we doing?
Glimmers of progress. I think the first thing we needed to do was a little bit like Alcoholics Anonymous, was admit there was a problem, own up to it, and begin focusing on it and give it the attention that it deserved. And that certainly has happened. Everybody's talking about patient safety and medical errors, and there's a lot of activity and a lot of different fronts trying to fix the problem. We've learned how sticky it is. It is a pretty tough problem. The things that I think we do much better than we used to are areas where we used to completely rely on human perfection and doctors remembering to do things and nurse kind of never blowing it. We've recognized that's not a safety solution. And so if you're a hospitalized patient today, I've heard this from lots of patients, patients say, boy, every single doctor or nurse who came into my room asked me my name. Are they demented? And the answer is no. They have recognized that if we don't do that, periodically we'll give a medicine to the wrong patient or take a patient off to a procedure that they didn't need but their roommate needed. So those sort of things, using checklists, standardization, double checks, those sort of things we're better at than we used to. But the more complex stuff, improving communication between doctors and nurses or between different kinds of doctors, building in computer systems that really work and get rid of a lot of the problems that relate to using handwriting and paper. We're really just beginning to make real progress.
Yeah, and just before going too much further, I think sometimes when we do programs like this, I worry that we're giving people just one more thing to worry about. And I think that you noted in either in the patient safety book or in Internal Bleeding, one or the other, that in fact that most hospitals most of the time are safe. So that does indeed though suggest this question. question, well, so you're going into the hospital. How concerned about this should you be?
Well, a little. And it's a very tricky message to get right. I think part of the problem, part of the reason we didn't begin aggressively tackling this issue until 10 years ago, was that many in the medical profession kind of worried about your question, that if we talk too openly about this, people will get scared and not come and get their surgery or come and get their whatever treatment they need. Most people, vast majority of people, come into hospitals, get good care, do very well. The vast majority of doctors and nurses and pharmacists are very well trained and do the best they can and provide high quality care. The problem is that, and we can't sugarcoat it, that every now and then, and at a frequency that's too high to be acceptable, things get screwed up. And one of the things we came to recognize was that if we didn't look at that problem and not blink from it and turn away from it, we weren't going to be able to fix it. We wouldn't be able to get the resources and the focus and the attention that we needed. So, you know, it is one of those sort of tricky messages. The message is don't stay home when you need to be in the hospital. Stay on your toes, be alert, be vigilant. Most of the time it will go well, but there are unacceptable numbers of errors and harm that befall patients who come into hospitals, and we need to fix that.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that it is the case, that it was the case in 1999, that nurses and doctors and everyone who works in the hospitals, they're concerned with the welfare of the people who come in. They're not casual about this. But at the same time, it seemed like perhaps this report, when it came out, was a little shocking, or, you know, it was the, if you forgive the cliche, it was the proverbial wake-up call somehow, that people knew that this was an issue, but was it the case that they just didn't know how big an issue it was?
I think it was partly that. I think it was partly the size and scope of the issue, and partly that our mental model for medical errors was all wrong. Hmm. And so part of the last 10 years has been playing catch-up ball, learning how other industries that are far safer than medicine approach the issue of mistakes, because this, of course, is an issue if you're flying airplanes or building railroads or if you're FedEx or you're Toyota. I mean, every industry has this concern about what happens when there are mistakes. Every other safer industry has gotten over the idea that you fix this by somehow making people perfect. They have recognized that safety is largely an attribute of a system rather than a flawless individual. And that doesn't take individuals off the hook. It doesn't mean that we don't need excellent doctors or nurses, and in the same way we need excellent pilots. But it has what happened really over the last decade was a recognition that if our approach to medical errors was simply to try to figure out who screwed up and then deal with it by shaming them, suing them, re-educating them, and trying to get them to be more careful, that would get us almost nowhere. That the real epiphany here was most errors are committed by good, well-trained, hard-working people trying to do the right thing, and all the error demonstrates is that they're human. And so making care safer really is a different way of thinking. It's how do we embed those people in systems that anticipate that these are human beings and they'll blow it from time to time and catch those errors before they cause harm. That's heavy lifting, because medicine is so unbelievably complex. This is not like getting an assembly line process right. The average patient in the hospital might be seen by 30 or 40 different people a day. So creating these systems and making them work and seamless is really, really tough work.
Well, let me pick up on one other point just real quick and have you respond, and then I have a caller I wanted to get to.
Sure.
For those people who, if they're thinking, why do these errors happen, maybe the first thing they might think about is incompetence. It sounds as if, in most cases, that's really not the issue. It's not because they're bad people, that they're careless, that they're not well trained, that they don't care. That apparently of all the things that contribute to that, that's way down on the bottom of the list.
I would say it's 10-20% of errors, maybe even less than that. It's not the most important issue. It happens, and those of us in the safety field have to be open and honest about that too. There are some bad doctors and nurses out there, but if we could purge them all tomorrow magically, we would still have probably 80 to 90% of this problem. It's really fundamentally a problem about how do you create safer systems.
Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Robert Wachter. He's professor, associate chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and has done a lot of speaking and writing about quality, safety, and health policy. He's the author of the book Internal Bleeding, The Truth Behind America's Terrifying Epidemic of Medical Mistakes. The book's now in its fourth printing. A more recent book that is primarily intended to be a textbook for medical education is Understanding Patient Safety. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about medical errors, why they occur, and how they can be addressed. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Champaign. Let's talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Wonderful to talk with both of you. I have a couple of questions here, and then I'm going to hang up and listen to your reply. Number one, it seems to me that as we move further and further toward third world conditions in our hospitals, we're all increasingly at risk. I would like to know more broadly what happens to uninformed, uneducated patients within our hospital system. It's hard enough for those of us who try to stay on top of information. I can't imagine what happens to those without well-informed friends, relatives who will sort of sit nearby and watch and listen and take notes. Number two, it seems to me that physicians rarely communicate with one another, or perhaps that the political system within a hospital setting or a clinical setting interferes. I had a very minor surgical procedure several years ago, maybe 7 minutes before it was to begin. The anesthesiologist came in to visit briefly and said, I don't really agree with the anesthetic that your surgeon is recommending. What do you think? And I thought, huh, this is just a dandy time to bring this topic up. So I sort of went along with what the anesthesiologist recommended, but I think that there is very little communication between physicians. If you would address those two issues, I'm going to hang up and listen, because I'm a little worried about the direction we're taking. We have few hospital beds. We have declining physicians willing to take risks. I certainly see why. Let us know your thoughts, and thank you so much.
All right. Well, and I know that particularly that the second matter that the caller brought up, this matter of communication between all of the various people who are involved in patient care, that's, I know, certainly is something that, that's very high on your list.
Well, yes, I think both points that the caller made are incredibly important and profound. Let me try the second one first, and we'll we'll peel back to the issue of, sure, of patient engagement. I've got two teenagers. They spend much of their life on Facebook when they should be doing their homework. And one of the things that strikes me is what a remarkable communication vehicle that is. And I don't own stock in it, but that through this portal, they're able to communicate with 10, 20, 30, 50 people at the same time, spread around the world, use video and audio and all sorts of modalities to keep people in the loop of their lives. On the other hand, in most hospitals in the country, the medical record is chicken scratch on pieces of dead trees. There is a silo for the doctors and another silo for the nurses and another for the physical therapists, and most of the professionals don't look at the other silos. And so part of the communication, the chart, quote-unquote, should be the vehicle or one of the vehicles through which we communicate with each other, and it serves that purpose very poorly. As we move into the electronic age, and unfortunately only about 10 or 15% of American hospitals have robust computer systems, but that will increase quickly, it's not that much better. Yes, you can read the handwriting now, but it's still very siloized and not very interactive. And so I think the medical record will ultimately need to look much more like Facebook to try to facilitate this communication. From a patient standpoint, and I think was implied in the caller's comments, what they don't get is why don't we all just talk to each other? Now, that of course makes a lot of sense. If you're an individual patient and I am taking care of you and you're being seen by five different consultants, why aren't we all kind of getting together in the doctor's lounge? What I think patients don't recognize is I have 15 patients like that. They each have five to seven different doctors involved, but they're all different sets of doctors, and so I would spend more than my day running around trying to talk to all of them. So although face-to-face and verbal communication is a very important piece of this, there's just no way logistically that we can communicate without using the medical record somehow to disseminate information around, and then there's the issue of not just doctor to doctor, but doctor to nurse, and it's a very complex problem, but I think the using new electronic models is going to be a key piece of this. In terms of the first point the caller made, very, very important, and she worried about what happens to the patient who doesn't speak English or is confused or doesn't have a family member around. I worry about that too, but I also wonder why it should be that a patient in a hospital needs to depend on having a well-informed family member to protect them from us. Ultimately, we have to protect patients from us. It should be that anybody who comes in a hospital can be reasonably assured that we will give them the right medicine, communicate with them appropriately in their language, give them the right treatments, keep them informed, and that needing to have a well-informed PhD on your shoulder available to translate or defend you at all moments is really evidence of a flawed system on our part. That said, if you have somebody like that who can be your advocate, I think today I would use that and it would be terrific. But to me, that's not the cure here. The cure here will be create a system where it doesn't matter that much whether a patient has an advocate or not, because we are their advocate and we're doing the right thing all the time.
So you don't, given the fact, as you say, that there may be a lot of different people involved in patient care, and apparently one of the places that errors really can occur is at the point where the responsibility for the patient is handed off from one person to another, it seems that, and maybe this is, the kind of thing you'd have in the best of all possible worlds, and we're not in that world, but it seems that if you had one person that was somehow responsible overall for thinking about the patient's welfare, from the minute they come in to the minute that they leave, that would be a good thing. Is it possible for such a thing to happen?
Well, yes, and in fact, you mentioned that I coined a term called hospitalist. That was the idea, and in a well-functioning hospitalist system, that is what happens. So the hospitalist is essentially a surrogate for your primary care doctor, but one who only takes care of patients in the hospital. And so the notion there is if you get hospitalized and you come into my hospital, for example, and I'm on that day, I come and meet the patient, and the first thing I say is, maybe in the old days of Marcus Welby, your primary care doctor could have served in this role, but now he or she is seeing patients every 13 minutes in the office, so there's no way that person can be there for you all day long in the hospital. You're going to see 20 different doctors and 30 different nurses and all that, and you will have the sense that there's nobody in charge, and I want you to know that that person is me. That's my job, is to be the orchestra conductor, to interpret for you, to integrate all this different information, to be the main conduit information and the final decision maker along with you. And so I think that works much better. I think if you have a good hospital system, it helps get at least part of the way toward what you're saying. That said, David, I can only work, so many hours a day and so many hours a week, and I might do a shift of a week and then be off. And so any way you cut it, there are going to be handoffs of information from one person to another, and we have to figure out ways of moving information around so that there isn't a drop in voltage every time there's those sort of handoffs, because they are inevitable.
All right. We will talk some more in just a moment here with our guest, Dr. Robert Wachter. We have a caller ready to go. Let us take a moment or two just to remind people that this is also a time that we're sitting in front of the microphones and asking for them to support the station. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you want to give us a call, 244-9455. 217 is the area code. Also, some people like to do it online. More and more people are making their contribution online, willpledge.org. What we're doing here is we're raising the money for the programs that will air next year. And by next year, I mean in the next fiscal year, which begins July 1st. We want to make sure the programs you enjoy today are here tomorrow. And you can make that happen and make it possible by giving us a call or going online and making a pledge. And here in studio with me is one of our producers, Martha Deal.
And no matter how much you decide to give, your contribution is important. What you give helps WILL become a bigger and more reliable, have a more reliable community support base. and you ensure the stability and sustainability of our programs that you depend on. You know, what happens when you tell all sides of the story? Our program this morning with Dr. Wachter is just another side of that. He's saying, hey, you know, we've recognized that there has been a problem in the past, and we're working to remedy that. You know, that's a side of the story you might not have heard someplace else. And we believe that our community is a better place because we all have access to information and understanding. On Focus 580, we connect you to people who are decision makers and opinion shapers. So please pick up the phone and support our programming. 217-244-9455. And thank you to the people who have called in, some 735 at this point.
All right. That's what we want to do here. We're just about getting close to our midpoint. We'll take some other callers here. We'll have one other opportunity to ask for your support. I just want to say one more time how important it is. We do get some federal money. We do get some state money. But, you know, those dollars have just shrunk. And now the most important source for the support that funds this program and other programs, folks like you. 217-244-9455, or you can go to our pledge site. That's willpledge.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items either made from recycled materials or are recyclable, like shopping bags, bag clips, and key tags. Information on their Go Green catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. And just let me again quickly introduce our guest, Dr. Robert Wachter. He's professor, associate chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California at San Francisco. Has done a lot of writing and speaking on the subjects of quality, safety, and health policy. He's the author of the book Internal Bleeding, The Truth Behind America's Terrifying Epidemic of Medical Mistakes. That book, I believe it was first published in 2004. It's now in its fourth printing, as had been a national bestseller. A more recent book dealing with the same subject, this one for people who are in the medical field, is Understanding Patient Safety. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And let's go to a caller here in Effingham County, line number four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, thanks for having the doctor on.
Sure.
I had an operation recently, and now they asked me if I had any jewelry or anything on. I got shrapnel in my right leg. Okay, now I, after I had this operation, that got me up, and this leg gave away with me, and I hurt my arm, and I've been having bars here lately, but I'm going to try to contact them and see if they'll x-ray my arm and so on. Now, if they, you know, will take care of it, I have no problem. But I want to know my rights on this situation.
Well, it's hard to know where to go with that. In general, if you are not satisfied with the care that you got, obviously there are a lot of different avenues, and probably the most important one is that every hospital has a patient relations department or a quality department, and those people are there essentially to hear about these kinds of issues. Now, probably the most important thing, obviously, is to approach your doctor first and find out what's going on. But I would encourage people to call the patient relations department. Often they can get to the bottom, figure out what's going on, and sometimes their piece of paperwork got lost. Sometimes it's that the medical folks are not being as responsive as they should be, and I would do that first.
Okay, well, that's kind of what I thought. Maybe get a hold of the patient rep and see if we could go from there.
Good. Yeah. Good luck to you. I hope you do well.
Thank you. Well, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that comes up, I'm sure, in these kinds of conversations when we talk about why errors occur has to do with overwork of staff, particularly residents, who, as part of their training, put in very, very long hours. And you have to wonder, well, if people are fatigued, if they're very, very tired, their judgment is maybe not going to be good, and that may indeed lead to problems. How large a factor do you think that is?
It's one of the many things that we had to fix, and where our thinking about it had been wrong during my training 25 or so years ago. I think the average work week was about 100 hours. I remember falling asleep driving home a couple of times, and that can't have been good. Not only because I was no doubt a little bit more error prone, but because it makes you grumpy, and that's not the way you want your doctor to be. Here too. There are some outside forces involved. So there's an organization that regulates medical training, and that organization about 4 years ago limited the number of hours that trainees could work down to, this still will sound insane, but down to 80 from what in some fields had been 100 to 120 hours a week. That sounds good. It sounds like it should be the right thing to do. Believe it or not, people like me thought in the year or two after that change that care became less safe. And how's that possible? Because all of a sudden, we now had far more handoffs of information. And just as we were talking before, each time there's a handoff of information, because it was much more shift work, there's the possibility of error. I think now it has improved things, because after seeing that, we've now got to work on how do we improve handoffs. And we look to other industries who have a lot of handoffs, including the military. How do they do it? Not in the haphazard way that we did. They don't write down patient information on the back of napkins in the cafeteria. They create computerized systems that support the information. They create a requirement that people sit down and talk to each other as they're going on and off shifts. And so as we've done that, it's gotten better. There are concerns among some medical educators that if we cut the hours too much and it's too much shift work, that the trainees won't learn what they need to do to go out and become independent practitioners. But I think 80 is certainly a more sensible number than 110, and I think we're beginning to make some progress on the handoff issue.
Yeah. Just for a second to go back to the subject of computerized medical records, this is a direction in which we are moving. I think that there are some, maybe a few concerns about how that's going to work, but also the thought is that there will be some benefits, certainly. Do you think that if we indeed do get that done, that will help the problem that we're talking about?
Yeah, it will. It certainly helps some of the problems immediately. It gets rid of my handwriting, which you want to get rid of. It allows different people to be looking at the same chart at the same time. If I'm at home at night and my residents are admitting patients, I can follow along and read their notes sitting at home, as opposed to when there's one paper chart, I can't do that. So those sort of things, it helps. A little bit more sophisticated system. You build in alerts where if I'm ordering a medicine to which the patient is allergic, the computer beeps me and says, you know, don't do that. Those sort of things are helpful. The problem is that it is very, very complex. The systems right now are still a little bit clunky. The user interfaces aren't great. And we're learning that there are new kinds of errors that computers introduce. Computers can be very effective error propagators if we don't get it right. But I do think that it's an inevitability. We have to get computerized. We have to ultimately get more sophisticated systems. And the Obama administration, as you probably know, just as part of the stimulus package, put $19 billion into computerizing healthcare. That was very important, because the computerization was a market failure. It did not happen on its own, because the economics of buying computers for hospitals or individual doctors' offices are not favorable enough to the doctors or the hospitals to get them to do it. You didn't need federal money to get the supermarket industry to computerize or get Walmart to computerize, but we did need a push. We did need something to get everybody over the hump to get healthcare to move in this direction. I think it's the right thing to do.
All right. And let's talk with someone in Champaign. They're a caller here on line number one. Hello.
Thank you so much for your show. Mm-hmm. This is very interesting. The question I have has nothing to do with hospitals, but it has to do with pharmaceuticals. I've been curious as to why two people who might weigh, you know, 100 pounds difference get the same medication, not the same medication, but the same amount of medication, the same number of, you know, volume of medication. And I have to wonder about, like, the little old lady who maybe weighs 105 pounds and she gets the same amount of Fosamax is somebody that might weigh 180 pounds. And this kind of, I have to wonder if one of them is getting over-medicated.
Yeah. Well, I think it is an important issue. I think only in the last 10 or 20 years have we truly begun thinking hard about particularly geriatrics and the use of pharmaceuticals in older populations, and recognize that for many medicines there is not a one-size-fits-all. We're very used to that in pediatrics, where for most doses of medicines in pediatrics, it's dosed on a weight basis. It's so-and-so milligrams per pound or per kilogram. And yet, as people get older, we have not thought about that. There are ways we do adjust doses. For example, if your kidney function is not as good as it used to be, and the drug is eliminated from your body in your urine, we will adjust the doses. But I think you're getting at something very important. Ultimately, it'll be more sophisticated even than that. I think we'll be in a world 10 or so years from now where the drugs are chosen not just because they work in 1,000 men or women, but work in people more like you. What is the right dose? What is the right medicine for you? And there's some hope, although it's taking longer than I think many of us hope, that ultimately we'd be able to customize this and personalize this in some ways based on your genetics. That's taking a little bit longer, and it's turned out to be harder than we hope. But ultimately, I think we'll get to the point where there's much more customization of medications based on your age, your weight, and maybe even your genetic makeup.
Well, that's very encouraging. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that I think has been suggested to try to, again, deal with the kind of problem that we're talking about, that is mistakes being made, is to somehow standardize procedures in the sense that we have checklists that you got to go through, or maybe we have decision trees where you first have a patient and then you're looking at what's going on with them, and it says, look for this and this and this. And if you see this, then look for this or do this, and have it be a very standard kind of set of steps that you want to go through as you're trying to assess the condition of the patient, what's going on with them, what symptoms do they have, what sort of treatments. And I think, though, on the other hand, I think there are some people who have said, well, if you're doing that, are you really sidelining all of the experience, the judgment that physicians accumulate over the time that they have been doctors, and they have concerns about taking the human factor out of it to some extent? And I wonder how you think about balancing those two things and how they apply to the kind of problem that we're talking about.
Well, I think you've captured the arguments perfectly, and I think that's right. The balance is what's key here. There's a lot of concern in my world among physicians about, quote, cookbook medicine. Right. Do we want medicine to become so algorithmic and in some ways bloodless that you come in and you're essentially a cog and we have a checklist and we do all of these things? And to my mind, the answer is yes, that is what we want to do precisely when we know that for patients like you in this situation, we need to do these six things religiously every time. You don't want to rely on my memory because maybe I had an argument with my kid or I'm distracted about something else or I'm seeing three people at the same time and juggling and I will forget. So when there are circumstances where a cookbook is the right tool, then we should use cookbooks. There was a very, very important effort done in the state of Michigan a year or two ago where to try to prevent infections that sometimes occur after patients have very large intravenous lines put in, largely patients in intensive care units, rather than relying on every doctor to remember the right things to do and every nurse remembering the right things to do, they put in a program in 100 intensive care units where they used a simple checklist. The checklist ensured that every patient got these five or six things. The number of deaths went down something like 60 or 70%. It saved thousands of lives. It saved millions of dollars. And it was kind of this duh moment, like, well, of course. On the other hand, we have to be careful because patients are not like packages going down the FedEx line. They are all different. They're all nuanced. Physicians do accumulate experience. And so I think we're trying to figure out the sweet spot here between the using cookbooks, using algorithms, checklists, standardization, when it is appropriate, and then but not creating a system that's so muscle bound and robotic that we can't innovate and improvise. My favorite example here is I work with a lot of pilots who come into healthcare to try to help us, And they sometimes come into the operating rooms at hospitals like mine, and they look around, and I've asked them what their impression was, and they say two things. One is it's really very impressive, very smart people, the technology is very cool. But the second is they'll ask a nurse, how do you set up the operating room for open heart surgery or for a hip replacement? And what they hear is, oh, for Dr. Jones, he likes us to set it up this way, and for Dr. Smith, he likes us to set it up that way. And they're flabbergasted because they say that would be like me walking into the cockpit of my 747 and saying, you know, set up the dials my own special way, or, you know, speak in tongues to me here because that's what I enjoy. Other industries that have made themselves safer have gotten over the notion that every individual should be able to have this customized environment because they've recognized that it's fundamentally unsafe. And that's some heavy lifting because we've gotten addicted to the idea that we can all create our own environment. It just doesn't work, so we need to standardize the things that we can.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting because it seems to me that for a long time there has been this human factors approach in a lot of fields to studying why bad things happen. It sounds that though that is fairly – is it my understanding you're saying that's fairly recent in medicine?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I was trained in medical school, I learned nothing about anything that I've told you about in the last 40 minutes, I've learned in the last 10 years. And, you know, I got trained in very good places and was a reasonably successful academic physician. This is a completely new way of thinking in medicine. And what's been fun about it, errors are not fun, but one of the things that's been incredibly engaging and interesting about it is we've gotten over our professional hubris enough to say, are there lessons out there from other fields that we can learn from? So the kind of thing I just talked about, we have collaborated with people in aviation or in the nuclear power industry or in the military to help figure out how do you folks do this, to do this complex thing safely and reliably, and this issue of human factors and studying the way people actually do their work really hinged on a rethinking of what our work is and the recognition that fixing this problem is not going to be about making better and smarter doctors. It really is about how do we create systems of care that ensure safety. That's a new way of thinking in the healthcare professions.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Robert Wachter. He's professor, associate chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California at San Francisco, and has done a lot of speaking and writing on the subjects of quality, safety, and health policy. Questions welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up, we'll talk with someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question concerning the uses of Dicumerol or Coumadin. My brother had a knee replacement, and he has been on Coumadin ever since. That happened 10 years ago, and he's still on Coumadin. And I'm concerned about having that applied to him for such a long period of time. The other thing is make a short comment on the uses of Plavix in conjunction with aspirin. So those two subjects I'd like you to comment on, and I will hang up and listen.
Well, thanks. It's probably not appropriate for me to comment too much on the individual decisions about this particular patient because obviously the doctors are going to know the situation better than I will. I'll just sort of broaden it to the issues that those drugs bring up. Coumadin is an oral blood thinner. It's a medicine that people take to thin their blood, as are aspirin when used for this purpose, and a medicine called Plavix. One of the things that we've recognized with these medicines, they're now on lists that we have called high-risk medications, meaning that when you need them, they're incredibly important because if your blood clots when it's not supposed to, you have something like a heart attack or a stroke. It can be very dangerous. On the other hand, if used incorrectly or if your blood gets too thin, there is a risk that you can bleed in all sorts of nasty ways. Here, too, for example, in the use of this drug called Coumadin, relying on every individual doctor to get it right is not as effective as creating a system of care. So many hospitals now have what are called anticoagulation clinics. When a patient is started on one of these medications, they're followed very, very carefully by a group of experts who know how these drugs work and how often you have to monitor the degree to which the blood is thin. These are the sort of interventions that when left to each individual patient and each individual doctor to kind of figure it out on their own, turn out to be too error-prone, and the stakes here are very high. If the Coumadin dose is wrong in either direction, the risk of the blood clotting when it shouldn't is too high, or the risk of bleeding when you shouldn't bleed is too high. So they're very good examples of this sort of new way of thinking around risky kinds of things that we do. Some patients need to be on Coumadin, though, for their entire life because the risk of clot can be devastating.
All right. Hope that that's helpful. We'll go next to Will County, line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. This is Will County.
Yes, go ahead.
I applaud the speaker's attention to discipline in other fields that make practice more rigorous. I won't belabor the matter, but I just am in a circle of people in engineering and in the finance world, and we despair at balanced notions like, well, the medical field is getting better and we're trying to organize things and we have some practices that we're improving. We think it's absolutely Neanderthal, the kind of practices and procedures that pass for routine SOP in the medical field. But I will get to one specific question. I want to go to the money because that seems to drive everything. The simple transaction issue of, I have a medical condition, it's not life-threatening at the moment, so sometime in the next month I'm going to treat it. I want to know who can do that, how much it's going to cost. I want the answers now or tomorrow, and by the end of the week I'll make my decision. Now, with 30-odd years of computational transaction processing in the hospitals, insurance companies, this kind of problem, which should be utterly dirt simple and is in manufacturing, finance, everywhere else, this kind of question utterly defies them. So I don't really have the confidence that we're getting there and a few more tens of billions get us over the hump and all that. I think I feel as if we have a lost cause. Give me some commentary on this and why you think that, let's say, 5 years from now, my simple question is answered in a phone call or an overnight letter.
Well, thank you, Ed. In terms of other industries that have got it right, I guess from my reading of the newspaper, finance would not be on that list these days. But nevertheless, I think what the caller is getting at is absolutely crucial.
$1 trillion worth of transaction an hour in finance, and the out trades are in the let's say thousands of a percent.
Yeah.
Proceed from there.
Yeah. I what you're getting at is right. I think that the financial piece is absolutely crucial here. And the way that goes is this, that if there is absolutely no skin in the game for hospitals to improve safety, meaning that they make the same money whether they're safe or they're not safe, patients have no idea whether this is a safe hospital or a safe doctor, then you can get part of the way there based on professional ethics. Believe me, the vast, vast majority of hospitals, hospital administrators, doctors, nurses want to provide safe care, don't want to harm people. But when it comes time to decide, are we going to invest $30 million in a computer system? Are we going to do teamwork training, as every airline does, to try to get doctors and nurses in the same room to learn how to interact with each other differently? Are we going to do simulation? These are very complex, expensive things. And if there is no business case to do it, there will be a big obstacle. So this is beginning to happen, I guess, and I think it's absolutely right. We're seeing it in public reports of quality measures. We're seeing it in pay-for-performance initiatives where hospitals will make more with good quality and less with bad quality. Where I'll take exception to the premise is that this is simple. It's extraordinarily complicated in healthcare. In other fields, I do believe that measuring the quality of the product is much, much easier than in healthcare. Part of the reason is if you take a big academic center like mine, patients who come here are the sicker of the sick. And so if we just look at whether they lived or died, we're going to look bad even if we're spectacularly good, because somehow you have to adjust for how sick the people were. So you have real challenges of how do you actually measure the quality and the safety of healthcare. I can tell you there's a huge amount of effort going into that, and it's being done in large part to answer your question, so that 5 years from now you can go to a website and figure out, is hospital A or B safer? and maybe hospital A will make more money because they're safer, or maybe you as a patient will choose hospital A because it's safer. And until we have that, we will only go so far in this revolution, and then we will stall out.
I want to thank the caller. I want to get one more here, and that's Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you so much for taking my call. This is a similar question. You mentioned earlier in the program about the need to get over the shame of reporting medical errors and mistakes in hospitals. And yet there's such a pervasive environment of risk management and the need to prevent suits. How do we balance those elements? And I very much appreciate your answer, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Yeah, the answer is I don't know. I think that's an incredibly difficult issue. On the one hand, we are trying to encourage in the medical profession people being much more open about their mistakes, talking about them, learning from them. I edit a website that's sponsored by the federal government where we report mistakes that are sent to us anonymously over the web, and we try to find the world's expert to comment on them. I think those sort of efforts are extraordinarily important. And on the other hand, you have looming over the entire thing the malpractice system, which most physicians find arbitrary and unfair and makes them want to hide things. And trying to strike the right balance there is a real struggle. I think what I've come to recognize, though, is that even if your primary goal is to avoid being sued and the malpractice system is looming on your mind, that the old way of thinking about this, let's just hide these errors, not talk about them, and just kind of move on to the next case, will ultimately lead to a much less safe environment. And there are some institutions and states that have encouraged more openness, and including apologizing to patients about errors and being really open and honest about them. And most of them have not shown increases in malpractice rates, that a lot of patients sue sometimes because they're angry that they felt like things were being covered up. So I think ultimately it's not only the right thing to do for us to be much more open with patients about this and much more open about with each other about what happened and how do we learn from it. Ultimately, I think that will decrease the risk of malpractice suits because ultimately we'll get to safer care.
There is no way in medicine that we can guarantee there'll never be a bad outcome. Certainly there are bad outcomes. There are things that happen that are no one's fault, and then there are those things that happen that maybe are someone's fault. Maybe not even all of them could have been prevented. I don't know if this maybe sounds like a really negative kind of question, but is there some sort of level of errors that we actually have to say that we'll accept, and where is that level in comparison with where we actually are now?
Yeah, I'm guessing there's no science on this. I'm guessing that if we had a perfect system that had the right computers, the right communication, the right teamwork, we'd probably be able to prevent about 75% of the errors that we have. And the 25% are that the science has just not taught us how to do this thing that you as a patient need without some possibility that something bad is going to happen. But that's a lot of room for improvement, and I think I could envision a world where the majority of the errors and adverse events that now occur in the course of healthcare don't happen to patients because we've created these safer systems.
There we must stop. Our guest, Robert Wachter, is professor, associate chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, has written and spoken a lot on these various subjects. He's author of the book Internal Bleeding, The Truth Behind America's Terrifying Epidemic of Medical Mistakes. The book is now in its fourth printing. He also recently has authored a book that's used as a textbook in med schools and in medical education. That book is Understanding Patient Safety. Dr. Wachter, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David. It was a great pleasure.